Hello, well, I'm going to talk about the suffragette movement, and I'm going to talk about sort of misconceptions that are commonly held in history, especially about the role of the Pankhursts. Pankhursts seem to be sort of put up on a historical pedestal, and they've become synonyms for the word suffrage. So Pankhurst and suffrage seem to go together, and the contribution of all these other female activists and groups have been marginalised, and I think they need to be rehabilitated. Of course, we're like radical historians, so I want to think about actually how radical are the Pankhursts, how radical were the suffragettes, not just in their means, their campaigning and their militancy, but in their actual aims. Okay, so a bit of background. Okay, so there were two main types of campaigners for female suffrage. There were the suffragists, whose campaign started in about 1865 when the first private members' bill was put forward by John Stuart Mill for an amendment to female suffrage. The suffragists used constitutional methods of campaigning, such as like petitioning and lobbying MPs. They held meetings and stuff like that. And they did win some small victories in terms of getting women involved in public life. They could sit on school boards and they could be poor law guardians. But after 40 years of campaigning, they still didn't have the vote. The other type is the women's social and political union and the suffragettes, who were militant campaigners. They were founded in 1903 by Emmeline and Christabel Pankhurst, Sylvia Pankhurst and some friends of that family, in Manchester. And from 1905 onwards, they used militant methods of campaigning. There's Emmeline and Christabel Pankhurst there when they came out of prison. Pankhursts were originally quite a left-wing family. Emmeline was the wife, and Christabel and Sylvia and Adela were the daughters of the left-wing politician Richard Pankhurst, who died in 1867. Although, as you'll see, the group moves more towards the right wing of the political spectrum, it did start off sort of ingrained in socialist ideas, but their first initial aims were to recruit more working class women and to get the Labour Party on side. Okay, so I want to think about really how radical were the WSPU? And some of the things, some of their attributes, you start to think, well, they weren't as radical as you'd previously think. One of the first things is the autocracy of the WSPU. It was run under a system of hierarchy. And there was complete lack of democracy within the group. The Central Committee, which basically comprised of the Pankhurst family, made all the decisions, sometimes helped by the subcommittee. They would then take these decisions to at-home sessions, where some women would come and have a meeting and they'd tell them what to do. And then 11 regional officers would go around the country and they would tell the women all over the country what had been decided by the Central Committee. But this lack of democracy, to some critics, is actually seen as quite hypocritical because they're trying to get the vote and trying to be involved in the country's political politics, but they don't even use it in their own society. Emmeline Pankhurst said, "We want our women to walk in step and take their instructions like an army." As I said, the initial aim was to recruit working women, but then it sort of lost the same and its original working class sort of socialist convictions. In 1906, you can really see this division and this movement. It split from the Independent Labour Party, who it had been really good friends with before and had helped with canvassing in 1906, and it moved to London. Christabel said she didn't want the WSP to be involved in party politics, and that was why she split, but also they really wanted to recruit women from the social elite. They wanted to move away from getting ordinary women involved, and they wanted to get women from the middle classes so that they could help them raise £20,000. But Christabel was, well, she was described by her sister as a bit of a Tory. She said that the Houses of Parliament should be more impressed by the demonstrations of the feminine bourgeoisie than of the feminine proletariat. And that's the reason she gave for breaking away from the IRP and trying to recruit these more middle-class, rich women. Again, this is called incipient Toryism by Sylvia. This is what Sylvia Pankhurst said were mainly her sister's views. She said, "A working women's movement is of no value. Working women are the weakest position of the sex. How could it be otherwise? The lives are too hard, the education too meagre to equip them for the contest. Surely it is a mistake to use the weakest for the struggle. We want picked women, the very strongest and the most intelligent. Again, so first of all you get the fact that they're not so radical and that they're a complete autocracy and a dictatorship. And the second part is that they were campaigning for votes on equal terms to men, and whether men could vote depended on a property qualification. They weren't looking for votes for all women, but middle class, upper class women. If these women were to be enfranchised, women who met the property qualification, women would only make up about 1/6 of the electorate, and that would mean that it would be difficult for them to push forward reforms to better the lives for women. And some people just thought, well, what is the point in that? Because we're not going to be able to change anything. The critic said that it wasn't votes for women, as is displayed there, but it was votes for ladies. Many women split away from the WSPU because of this, because they felt that they'd sold out their ideas and that they didn't think it was right just to be campaigning for votes for a very small number of women. They also didn't like the lack of democracy and the fact that it had become exclusively middle class. And so here's an example of a few of these women and why they did break away. Dora Montefiore was probably the second most prolific female British communist, and she set up the first Canning Town branch of the WSPU in London. Thing is, she did this without asking Pankhurst beforehand, and because it was an autocracy, you had to ask their prior approval before doing anything, and they didn't like this independence. She had a lot of friction, as did Adelaide Knight, who was the secretary of the Canning Town branch, and the women there, because when it was set up, it advocated adult suffrage, and the WSPU really didn't like that at all. She said that they'd broken their promises to the working women, and that it was a betrayal of what the group had actually been set up upon. With the inclusion of more conservative, middle-class feminists, people who first founded the organisation had to keep their left-wing ideas sort of under wraps. They weren't allowed to say what they thought because they didn't want to offend these women who could give them financial support. Adela Pankhurst was the youngest of the Pankhurst sisters, and she was called the black sheep among organisers. Now, Adela failed in this respect. She did a speech advocating adult suffrage, and she sort of put forward all these values that she thought the organisation had been founded on, but had been moved away from over time under her sister's autocratic sort of regime. And because she did this and offended these women, her mother essentially banished her to Australia. She said, "You're not allowed to speak in public in Britain again," and gave her £200 to go and move away to the other side of the world so it didn't taint their movement. Theresa Billington Wright is probably one of the most well-known opposers of the WSPU. She really didn't like how undemocratic it was, and she thought that the autocracy was, again, hypocritical, and it was quite counterproductive because it wasn't teaching women how to work within a society. In 1907, there was a big national conference of all the different branches of the Women's Social and Political Union, and for this she drafted a new constitution which gave sort of motions to make it more democratic and take like the power away from Emily and Christabel and let rank and file members have more of a say in what they were fighting for and what they were doing. But Emmeline Pankhurst didn't like this at all. She took the constitution in front of all the people and tore it up dramatically, made a big speech saying that nobody had to be in her army if they didn't want to be. This is what Theresa said about the WSPU when she left it. She said, "It has cut down its demand from one of sex equality to one of votes on a limited basis. It has suppressed free speech on fundamental issues. It has gradually edged the working class element out of the ranks. It has become socially exclusive, punctiliously correct, gracefully fashionable, ultra-respectable and narrowly religious." But I think basically that sums up why a lot of women opposed and broke away from the WSPU, because they were fed up with it moving away from what it was founded upon to becoming this sort of right-wing, sort of conservative, socially exclusive group. Many radical female Chartists distanced themselves from the suffrage movement because they thought it was really middle class, and they thought that was quite counterproductive to try and be fighting for a very small measure of suffrage, because that wouldn't really help the working classes in any way. Okay, another thing I want to talk about is that militancy is seen as very radical, and of course it was incredibly brave. But some of the tactics they used, which were militant, again, alienated completely the working class. It was a great publicity sort of maker, and it shows how passionate and serious they were. But working women found it very, very difficult to actually join in these activities, because if they were found to be involved, they could have lost their jobs. And their families were so dependent upon their income, they couldn't join in. Here we've got a picture of Emily and Christabel Pankhurst in Holloway Jail. Lots of suffragettes would go to jail, be force-fed and things like that, but in the media and in the public eye, they would play upon this idea that respectable middle-class women were being mistreated by men. And that's really alienating working-class women again, because they have always been put in prison, always been mistreated badly, and they were using this sort of image of a woman who shouldn't be put in prison because of her class and shouldn't be treated the same as a working class woman would be. And again, this sort of alienates them and it makes them more middle class and elitist. There were lots of encounters with the police, with the WSP. Again, really brave, sort of put themselves out on rallies. For example, Black Friday is quite a well-known event. I think it was on the 10th of November 1913 when lots of suffragettes had a big parade and policemen in plain clothes came and beat them up. But they advertised it all around the town. Sometimes they would put themselves deliberately in situations where they could be arrested and they could play the victim, which sort of, I think, it, like, enforces the hegemony of gender stereotypes. They were campaigning to be recognised as being a strong, responsible, mature and worthy of respect as men, then undermining it by playing on the patriarchal perception that women were frail, helpless creatures who had to be treated with greater care and special consideration. Another problem with militancy was that the government at the time really didn't want to give in to terrorists because they were facing so much insurrection and fights in Ireland. And they thought, well, if they give in to these women, people are going to think that that's a method that they're going to give in to all the time. This is an arson attack in 1913 on Hurst Park Racecourse. Again, working women found it really, really difficult to join in with stuff like this, because if they went to prison, there was absolutely no way that their families would be looked after. They'd lose their income, and there would be no one to look after their children or their husband. Whereas middle-class women had maids and people like that. Another reason they found it difficult to be involved in the group was that the meetings and things like that would be held in places where middle-class women could come together, and at times middle-class women didn't work. They had a lot of spare time where they could come together and meet in their own homes. It was quite a social event. But they didn't do it at times where working women who had to work, who had to look after their family, could come and join in. And also, it would be quite difficult for working-class women to be in a middle-class estate. Another reason to sort of question how radical the WSPU were was that, thinking about their policies in general, they were so set on one thing, which was gaining the vote for a limited measure of franchise for middle-class women, to the point where Emmeline Pankhurst actually forbade any of her women from joining in other social reforms. She said, "Our women members are absolutely single-minded. They concentrate all their forces on one object, political equality with men. No member of the WSPU divides attention between suffrage and other social reforms." Now, opposing groups and opposing people just thought, well, what on earth is the point in that? What's the point in having the vote if you don't know how to use it and sort of aim towards more sex equality, bringing laws and stuff that would help women in their social lives and just in life in general, rather than just focusing on this one object? Okay, so Sylvia Pankhurst, unlike her sisters, really, really stuck to what they believed in when they first set up the group. She probably is the most prolific female British communist. In 1912, she went to London against Christabel and Emmeline's will to try and set up a branch of the WSPU in Bow, which of course is a really working class area, and they didn't like this because they didn't really want to involve working class women, because they really wanted to strive towards getting the vote for middle class women. And they said that they didn't like the idea of how the group was set up, the East London Federation of Suffragettes, because it was more democratic, included working class women, and because men were allowed to join it, and it was run by women, but men were allowed to sort of ingrain themselves. So here's Sylvia Pankhurst when she first went to Bow, and they rented out a baker's shop, and she painted Votes for Women across the top. And this is her speaking to normal working class women about what it would mean to them if they managed to get the vote for all people. This was a group that obviously had a lot of friction between them and the WSPU. In 1913, Sylvia, who was the head of this, was summoned to France, where Christabel had been hiding, because she was really worried about being arrested again. She'd been arrested many times, so she was out hiding in France. And she told her sister that the ELFS was not part of the WSPU anymore because it was too working class and it was too democratic. So not only had they distanced Adela Pankhurst, they now distanced Sylvia Pankhurst and broke away from them. They would really do anything to stop their movement being tainted by working class ideas. Okay, lots of differences between groups can be seen with their reaction to war. In 1914, Christabel's autocratic rule gave her the power to suspend all militant activities in the group against the will of quite a lot of women. Quite a few broke away from the group at this point. In return for suspending their militancy and helping the government released lots of women who'd been put in jail. They started a vigorous patriotic campaign, and their reaction to war is really like completely different. They've been fighting against the government and now they're working with it. They start calling for conscription into the armed forces for working class, well, all men. They are the people who organise giving out white feathers to people who wouldn't fight. And the leaders do stuff like they go to Russia and they give speeches to Russian women to try and keep their men out fighting. The ELFS, however, sort of set up an employment bureau. They set up things to give out free milk to mothers. They tried to unionise women in these industries that they've now taken over because men were fighting. And they tried to campaign against price rises and things like that. They were also quite keen on campaigning for peace, which is completely different to the WSPU, who were really quite patriotic. In fact, they were so patriotic, they changed their name of their journal from Votes for Women to Britannia. Tried to get these people to support the government in their patriotic war. In 1918, the Representation of the People Act was passed, which meant women over 30 who were on the local government register or met the property qualifications previously imposed on men were granted the vote. This is attributed to lots of factors, one being women's contribution to the war effort, one being the sort of circumstances that came about because of the war. The setting up of a provisional government meant that there was lots of cross-party agreement between parties on female suffrage. But it's also to do with the long campaigns held by both the suffragists and the suffragettes beforehand. So now I want to talk about another group which I think were quite radical, and they're called the Radical Suffragists by Jill Liddington and Jill Norris. They wrote a book called One Hand Tied Behind Us, which really sort of discovered what all these working class women in the North had been doing to contribute to the suffrage movement way before, and during the suffrage movement. And their contribution has been completely marginalised and needs to be rehabilitated. They wanted not just the vote, but they saw it as a means towards social reform and ending the exploitation in work. They wanted stuff like birth control, and they wanted just like to unionise women, get them more active in the workplace, sort out stuff like the gender pay gap. But then again, getting the vote for them was a lot harder, because it was a lot harder for them to campaign, to fit it in their daily life. But it was a lot more important because these were women whose lives really were very, very difficult. One radical suffragist said, "No cause can be won between dinner and tea, and most of us who were married had to work with one hand tied behind us."
They did their meetings at times when women could attend, all women.
And they did stuff like, they would petition at their factory gates. Over 60,000 women in the north signed this petition to be sent to Parliament for an amendment to female suffrage. And although they were initially campaigning for votes for women on equal terms to men, they saw this just as a stepping stone to universal suffrage for men and women. Helen Silcott was a trade unionist and one of the members of the Radical Suffragist Group. And she was the first woman really to raise the issue of female suffrage at the trade union conference in 1901. The trade unions, obviously, had been very quite hostile towards women because women were easily exploitable and could be paid a lot less for the same job as men. So men saw that they threatened them in the workplace. So before they'd been hostile, but this woman was really brave and she raised this issue. And she said that women really do need protecting, they need the vote. So it was that very meeting that the TUC called a motion for adult suffrage for both men and women at that conference. One of the arguments she used was this. Now, it was quite a big argument against female suffrage, saying that they were already protected by men and that they didn't need the vote. But she said, it is said that women are sufficiently protected by their husbands. I will point out that not all women are wives. There are, in fact, 5 million working women in this country who have to earn their own livelihood. Some protection should be extended to them so that by means of the vote, they may assist in bringing about legislation which will enable them to live and not merely to exist. In trade unions, 2/3 of people in sweated industries were women in the north. And although women like paid their subscription, a lot of them really couldn't attend and they wanted to change this. And like their experience joining in with the union movement, being involved in stuff like the Wig and Weavers Association and the Women's Cooperative Guild, sort of really proved effective because they got the backing of men and women at a grassroots level. And they brought the issue of social change and enfranchising women to normal people. And they didn't try and do it as sensationalists, like on a public, massive national level. They tried to get it just into the lives and minds of ordinary working women. Selina Coop was quite a big sort of name associated with this group. She was the first working class woman to be elected as a poor law guardian. And she was chosen along with 4 other more middle class women to present a petition to Parliament on women's suffrage. So she'd been involved in just standing at the factory gate, getting women to sign this petition. She herself got about over 800 signatures individually. And they took this petition down to give it to Asquith. It's important to note that during the suffragette campaign, the suffragist campaign was still going on. They were still holding these meetings and still trying to get the vote. And every single one of the members in the radical suffragists that you know a lot about were all involved in wider social reforms. They all wanted to get like better conditions for all workers and they wanted to birth control and things like that. And again, it comes back to the idea that the WSPU wanted just the vote for middle class women. And they didn't want their women to be involved in social reforming and stuff like that. But Selina Cooper says, women do not want their political power to enable them to boast that they are on equal terms with men. They want it for the same purpose of men, with as men, to better conditions, to make the lot of the worker pleasanter. We do not want it as a mere plaything. And she saw that, she just said, like, what on earth is the point in just getting a vote for a small majority of women if they don't know how to use it? So sort of sum up their aims. For Christabel and the WSPU, the movement was a struggle for privileged and educated women to take their seat in the government and represent their class interests. Christabel and Sylvia sort of show the different ideas towards suffrage. For Sylvia, the East London Federation of Suffragettes and the radical suffragists in the north and other working class groups, the suffrage movement was a struggle for freedom from want, poverty and oppression, and they saw enfranchisement as a stepping stone towards social reform. Okay, so this is some women voting. And this is the sort of conclusions I've come to. But women gaining the vote in 1918 is popularly attributed to the exploits of the Pankhurst and the militant suffragette movement. But in fact, thousands of women from across the country in every social class were involved in this campaign, and they were the ones that brought the issue into the public eye at grassroots level and really showed, like, the normal woman what she could do. The East London Federation of Suffragettes, for example, used to hold classes for working class women on issues sort of such as birth control and on issues of getting the vote and what it could mean towards their social lives and bettering their lives in general. The granting of limited female suffrage is somewhat attributed to the women's contribution in the war effort. If we see it like that, which is quite a popular idea, the women that did the most work were mainly working class, and they were in their teens and their 20s. They were the ones who were doing the work of a man and challenging this perception that women couldn't do the same jobs as men. The suffragists also showed that women from every class were capable of operating within the democracy which they were trying to gain inclusion, and it challenged the idea that women weren't capable of understanding politics. A problem was that the government thought that if women were involved in politics, they might become sort of unfeminine and lose their femininity and become violent, and some crazy people thought, well, they wouldn't be able to conceive. Whereas these women were... the suffragists showed that they just knew what they were doing, how to campaign constitutionally, and that it was very, very easy for them to be involved in politics, whereas the suffragettes sort of conformed to this image that women would become violent and strange and different if they would try to dabble in politics themselves. And in terms of feminism and wider emancipation, the radical suffragists and the East London Federation of Suffragettes sort of set the ground for campaigning for better lives for women and sex equality, which would follow in the years subsequent to the suffrage movement. The WSPU were only interested in campaigning for the vote and not for wider social reform. This is why I think these women deserve more recognition, and we need to think really, how much did the WSPU do? Yeah, they campaigned for votes for some women, but not for all of them. And they weren't trying to get women in a position of equality with men. They were just trying to get the vote. Okay.